fatal crash last year, Senator Quill said.
Three flights, Senator, Dan replied. The first one was unmanned, I mean automated.
And the more recent two flights?
Both were piloted, and both were completely successful.
What about that first flight, the one that crashed? Asked the senator at the far end of the banquette.
Dan gave his carefully prepared answer. The FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board have concluded that the accident wasn't caused by a generic flaw in the spaceplane's design or manufacture. Our successful flights with the second spaceplane show that the crash was caused by the malfunction of a thrust actuator, which has been corrected.
Isn't the FBI investigating the crash? Isn't there a possibility that it was caused by sabotage?
The crowd stirred and reporters began whispering into their phones. Dan suppressed a frown. He had agreed with the FBI people in Houston to keep their investigation hush-hush. Not that they found anything, he reminded himself. But there aren't any secrets when a U.S. senator wants to get his face on national TV. Aloud, he answered, Senator, we just do not know what caused that actuator to fail. Even NASA is stumped by the accident.
Was it an act of terrorism?
The senator insisted, looking straight into the TV cameras. Dan shook his head glumly. You'll have to ask the FBI about that, sir. More questions. None of them hostile. Finally, Quill looked down the table toward Jane.
I invited Senator Thornton to these proceedings because she has introduced legislation that has a bearing on financing high-technology ventures such as yours. Senator Thornton, do you have any questions for this witness?
Jane sat up a little straighter as Dan thought, I have a question for you, Senator. When am I going to see you again?
Mr. Randolph, Jane said, coolly impersonal. What effect would it have on financing ventures such as yours if the government offered guarantees for long-term, low-interest loans?
Dan had rehearsed the answer with Jane for a week before this hearing, but only over a video phone link. In the 7 months since her surprise visit to Matagorda, Dan had been in the same room with her exactly twice, and both times there had been a crowd separating them, and Scanwell. Almost automatically, Dan went through their prepared tutorial on financing high-technology ventures.
There are three factors involved, he told the subcommittee. First, high-tech ventures are almost always high-risk. In my business, for example, every rocket launch has a considerable amount of risk involved, although we're reducing those risks quite a bit.
Quill nodded, and Dan got the impression that Jane had already briefed him about this.
Second, he went on, high-tech ventures usually involve a large investment. You can't build satellites and spacecraft on a shoestring budget.
You're talking billions of dollars? Asked one of the senators.
Hundreds of millions, at least.
What's the third factor? Quill prompted.
Time, said Dan. The investor's money is going to be tied up for a long time, years, maybe a decade or more.
Not a 90-day turnaround, Jane said with a smile.
No, not at all, Dan replied. If you put all those three factors together, high risk, high investment cost, and a long time before payout, you can see why it's so difficult to raise investment capital.
Would a government guarantee of long-term low-interest loans be of help? Jane asked.
It already has, Dan said. Astro Corporation has been working from loans raised in the private sector for the past several months. I'm certain that this legislation you've introduced in the Senate has opened that door for us.
One of the senators quipped,
Well, if it's worked that well for you, maybe we won't have to pass the bill.
A few of the other senators chuckled tolerantly.
Jane did not, Dan noticed. He suppressed an urge to snap a snotty answer at the flippant senator. Any other questions for this witness? Quill asked, looking up and down the table. If not, then the witness is excused.
Before I go, Dan said, I have a short statement to make, Senators.
Quill looked down at Dan. As long as it's short.
Dan didn't quibble with the Senator's choice of words.
I just want to tell you, Senators, that we intend to start beaming power from the satellite in 2 weeks.
The hearing room erupted. The cameras all focused on Dan.
Reporters flicked open their cell phones and began yammering into them. The senators looked at each other up and down the long banquette while the audience burst into dozens of chattering conversations.
In the midst of it all, Rick Chatham leaped to his feet, ponytail flying, and shouted, "You can't do that! I'll get a court injunction!" Quill began tapping on the wooden block in front of him, harder and harder, the impatience on his face morphing into red-faced anger. But it did no good. The reporters swarmed around Dan, yelling questions at him. Vicky Lee was among them, but Dan looked past them all to search for Jane. Her chair was empty. She had already left. Dubai International Airport. Asim al-Bashir strode along the sand-toned carpet, which was patterned in curling arcs such as the wind would stir on the desert floor. Golden replicas of graceful palm trees lined the corridor of the Sheikh Rashid Terminal. Tourists and pilgrims thronged the duty-free shops where goods from all over the world were on display for the avid travelers. Al-Bashir disdained the merchants and buyers alike. Beyond the terminal's windows, he could see the garish skyline of high-rise office towers and hotels, including the 30-story-high sail shape of the Burj Al Arab Hotel. Western ostentation, he sneered inwardly. Instead of resisting the West's garish culture, they imitate it and even exceed it. When he entered the private lounge that had been reserved for him, the Egyptian was already there, looking distinctly morose in his poorly fitted white linen suit. Al-Bashir himself wore a hand-tailored silk suit of royal blue. No, Al-Bashir decided, the Egyptian is not depressed. He's apprehensive, fearful. This business of the power satellite is beyond his capacity. Al-Bashir had bowed to the Nine's wish for a face-to-face meeting between the two men. The Egyptian had insisted it be in a location in the Muslim Middle East, where they would be relatively safe. Relatively, Al-Bashir thought with a thin smile. The United States Army occupied Dubai and the other Emirates. Despite occasional suicide bombings, the Americans were tightening their stranglehold on the Gulf. Well, that will change soon enough, Al-Bashir thought. The Egyptian sat with his back to the window and its view of the skyline, while a uniformed airline employee poured coffee for the two men and then made his quiet departure. "You seem apprehensive, my brother," Al-Bashir said to the Egyptian.
"Randolph plans to turn on the power satellite in 10 days."
"Yes. He made his grand announcement at the Senate hearing last week." Al-Bashir picked up the delicate cup and sipped at the coffee.
"Randolph made a bold gesture."
Al-Bashir smiled. "I have come to know the man. He is an egomaniac at heart."
"Still, will we be ready in 10 days?
Tapping the data disk encased in the breast pocket of his suit jacket, Al-Bashir replied, "I have the complete blueprints of the satellite. Once it begins beaming power to the ground, we will seize it and shift the beam to Washington."
"You can do that?"
"Quite easily. While Randolph's technicians in Texas are trying to determine what's gone wrong with their satellite, we will concentrate the microwave beam and kill thousands."
"Including their president?"
"It is all arranged. Despite his own high opinion of himself, Randolph is a trusting soul, a typical American. I helped him to get the financing he needed, so he believes I am his friend. He has opened his entire operation to me. They are all pathetically naive."
"You are certain this will work?"
the Egyptian asked, reaching for his own coffee cup.
"The others of the Nine are rather concerned."
"Tell them it is written. Once the power satellite begins to work, we will turn it into a death weapon against the enemies of Allah." The Egyptian smiled minimally and appeared to relax somewhat. Al-Bashir smiled back at him. As they sipped the strong, hot, sweetened coffee, Al-Bashir told himself sternly, "Let him believe that we strike in the name of Allah. Let the others believe that I am a fighter in the war between Islam and the West. But don't let yourself fall into such a belief. Religion has its purposes. Use their faith, but remember your goal. Tricontinental oil and the power to bend nations to my will." The skyline of Houston was almost as garish and much larger than Dubai's. Sitting behind his desk in the FBI building, Nacho Chavez took a bite of the breakfast burrito he was holding in his right hand, wrapped in a napkin that was already soaked with grease.
It's got to be Al-Bashir.